Yeah, I wasn't quite sure if I really should give this talk, but I was.
Twisted your arm.
I was helped by the organizers in this decision. And the problem I'm going to talk about is relatively complicated, and I'm not sure, I mean, we are actually getting the right answer or having something which is worthwhile. But since this is going to be published in PRL, this work I'm going to talk about, and it was just unlucky circumstances because the referees in PRL just gave the wrong arguments. I mean, they never addressed my worries. So, you know, they were taking off on some, you know, tangent, which was, you know, easily defendable. So I just pushed it through. But hey, you know, I think it's some work which should get attention in some ways, and, you know, might lead to something interesting if pursued further. So what you see here is more or less a progress report on our thinking about non-equilibrium properties of strongly correlated systems, and I think that's a very interesting problem and should be addressed. And maybe if we combine forces, I mean, there actually could be coming something out of it. Okay, I don't have my favorite cartoon with me, which is a Gary Larson cartoon, which is Professor Zork with his controversial technique of exposing patients at the same time to the fear of height, snakes, and fire. So you see an elevator hanging out of the window, and there's a patient in there with snakes and fire and all. And, so, you know, the non-equilibrium problem is a little bit like that. I mean, and especially in the strongly correlated systems, you are trying to solve, you know, basically unsolvable problems. I mean, one is the strongly correlated system where we just made, you know, a little bit of progress with the DMFT. And then in addition to that, you would like to address the question of non-equilibrium.
Who's so, the
okay, the snake is the experiments. So, there you have it. Okay. So just to illustrate that point, I would like to mention that, I mean, people who are trying to address questions of non-equilibrium are studying mostly classical systems. So there's a large group of people studying classical systems out of equilibrium, and what these people usually look at are simple, you know, simple problems like a chain, where you have particles hopping on this chain with a different hopping rate in each direction, or with, you know, similar hopping rates in each direction, and you fill in particles here and you take out particles over there. And depending on the parameters of the system, you get different phases. You can actually see something like Bose condensation. You know, they call it Bose condensation, which is basically a traffic jam of these particles moving here. And, you know, depending on all of these parameters, like, you know, these hopping rates to the right and to the left, you get, you know, a complicated phase diagram. And actually, you can view it as a quantum problem if you map these one-dimensional classical models to Hamiltonian. And then this Hamiltonian is, of course, non-Hermitian because you're filling in particles on one side and you're taking out particles on the other side. And so it's a non-Hermitian quantum problem. And that certainly, I mean, ensures you that you cannot apply any of the things you know from statistical mechanics, like, you know, just taking a density matrix or taking averages in the usual way. So, you know, already on the classical limit, non-equilibrium problem can be extremely complicated and extremely rich in the physics. And there are a couple of people, you know, I just wrote a few names which came to my mind, who are working on these problems and have a lot to say about these complicated, you know, many body problems in classical systems. Now, if you look at quantum systems, then, of course, I mean, we in experiment, we see these non-equilibrium physics. For example, take a periodic quantum system, apply a strong electric field, so you tilt the potential in this way, you have these little potential wells, and then you fill in particles in this, and then, of course, I mean, you have the same problem as you had in the classical problem, that, you know, there is a hopping rate in this direction. And if you would like to describe that system, you have to again, try to address this non-equilibrium problem, but in the problems where where I have looked at and, you know, tried to see what people have been doing in this respect. And the things I came up with, I mean, is that people who looked at mesoscopic systems, where you, for example, have quantum wells, you know, and you connect the quantum wells and expose them to a strong electrical field, then, you know, what people usually use is Kalish formalism. And, you know, there were also recent attempts with randomization group for one of these problems. So if you want to look at experimental realizations of these problems, I mean, you basically can look at an array of quantum dots. So that would give you a strongly correlated system. And when you apply electric field, you would be in this situation. You can think of atoms in an optical lattice. And I will talk a little bit about that in a short while. You can talk. You can think about correlated electrons in a solid, and as I said, quantum wells are another problem you can look at, you know, to see this non-equilibrium physics. Now, the problem with this non-equilibrium physics is, again, if you want to think about it in a very general way, what you have is a system where you cannot really differentiate between the bath and the system itself. And that's the problem in these statistical mechanics problem. And if you start to do something like Kalish formalism, you still try to differentiate between a thermal bath and the system itself. And, you know, we are restricted in the quantum system to that approximation. And you will see what we have been doing in a short while. Just to mention these other systems where you have strong correlations, quantum mechanics, and non-equilibrium physics. If you think about the ultra-cold atoms in a lattice, then you can think of, you know, two different phases. For example, this mod insulator phase, which for the bosons is very simple. You have just a commensurate ordering of these ultra-cold atoms in this optical lattice, and then the superfluid phase, where you have some coherence of these atoms over the lattice. Now, if you tilt this lattice, I mean, by just applying, for example, the gravitational field, right? I mean, you just tilt the trap and then, you know, the bosons or the atoms start to slide, then you are precisely in this non-equilibrium situation. Or you can apply a strong electric field and then you are precisely again in this non-equilibrium situation. The people who have actually realized this, I mean, I just mentioned here to advertise their work, but there is also some very nice work by Subir Sachdev, who is thinking about these problems in the non-equilibrium case. And if you want to look at this problem, I really recommend you to look at the work of Subir. And it's very nice, relatively complete, and you know, it's always hard to compete in a field with Subir, but, you know, most of you know that. Now, the problem I'm going to address is something which is related to some experiment or motivated by some experiment. But, you know, in the end, it will turn out that I will not have that much to say about this particular experiment. But at least, you know, you will get some feeling for what the physics will be like. Now, what I have been looking at, or what I was motivated by, really, was a pump and probe experiment where you take a sample of strongly correlated material, and you pulse it with a strong laser pulse, and then you probe it with another laser. And the material which people were looking at were the strontium cuprate, which is a quasi one-dimensional material. Now, the thing to observe here in these figures, if you can see, this is the change in the transmission, the relative change in the transmission as a function of time, as a function of the probe and the pump frequency of the laser. Now, what you can observe there is that, number one, if you cannot read the number, this number is minus 0.5, this is minus 1. If you look at the figures, at the numbers here, this is an enormous change in the transmission coefficient, which is much, much larger than, you know, most of the things you have seen in semiconductors. So this is an enormous effect. The second point one should observe is that the recovery rate can be extremely short. I mean, if you look at these decays of the recovery of the signal or of the transmission, you can see that it's in the picosecond range. So this is, again, I mean, a relatively short time. And when I looked at this paper by Ogasawara et al., the theoretician on the paper they consulted was Maekawa, and you know, I tried to understand where this fast recovery rate was coming from, and there were only some mumbles about, you know, a silent spin channel. And when we looked at this problem and tried to understand, I mean, what is the silent spin channel which could give you this rapid recovery rate, it turned out that, you know, all the matrix elements you can think of basically didn't give anything reasonable. But, you know, this was just the starting point for me. And just to give you a little bit more details, what the claims were in this paper was that the one photon and the two photon processes are nearly degenerate in the special 1D material. And then they were saying basically because of the large dipole moment you get from that, you can couple the light very strongly and you get a large nonlinearity. And as I said, the spin excitation, which they never actually, you know, pointed at, was supposed to be responsible for this ultra-fast recovery rate. So the questions we asked were then, I mean, you know, is this effect limited to 1D compounds, and how do you do the coupling to the spin excitations? And as I said, I mean, the result of our looking into this was negative. But then, you know, let's consider a more general problem, where you have a strongly correlated system and you pump it with some strong laser pulse. And you know, you will see that it's not really possible to do it in the way I'm telling you. But you know, I think in the end there will be an experimental realization in some other system where maybe one can see the physics I'm telling you now. Okay, so what I would like to consider is, let's say, a MOD insulator. And I would like to drive it with some strong external field. This can be a light, you know, light or, you know, some other external field which couples to the electrons. Now, when we are sitting in the mod phase, we just have the two mod bands, and you know, nothing is going to happen that much, and you only excite over the gap. And that's all you can do at this point. Now, let's assume, I mean, that you really can push the system very, very hard. The states which are sitting here in the mod gap, in the mod states, in these mod bands, are really strongly correlated electrons. What this means is that you cannot really talk about single particle excitations, but you know, you have this whole tail of multiparticle excitations attached to all of these electrons. Now, when you push the system very, very strongly, what should happen? In some ways, you know, what I imagine would happen is that you disentangle these complicated many-body states, and you decompose it again into single particle states or some sort of single particle states. So if you want to think about it diagrammatically, which is, you know, sometimes easier, what you can imagine it when you talk about a MOD insulator, then you have large energy denominators just because of the Coulomb repulsion. Now, when you put in this extra frequency, the extra energy from the external perturbation, then what you do is you stick in something there which is single particle, but you know, it has a large weight. And what that means is basically you get rid of the strongly interaction physics and you can go back to the single particle physics. So what you could imagine is that you basically disentangle these complicated many-body states and get something back which looks a little bit like the original, you know, density of states of the system. And that was the basic motivation for looking into this problem after, you know, looking at the experiment. Now, what that would imply is that...
Yes. Be careful not precisely defining what you mean by this red curve.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's some sort of density of states, if you want.
At some instantaneous time, or...
Yeah, we will.
I guess you.
I will. You know, give you more details. I mean, after a while. But you know, let's first. You know, try to understand. I mean, what I really would like to point at. Now, what this should imply. I mean, if there are any states down here in the gap, then you know, what you would get is also a relatively large photoconductivity, and this photoconductivity could be very, very nonlinear, because you have nothing in the gap, and you know, you get something.
But basically, the physics that we would like to investigate, for example, is how to drive a multi-insulator metallic by pumping in carriers with laser, right?
Right.
That's what you.
Right. You know, it's not necessarily laser. I think. I mean,
whatever,
it's unrealistic with yes, right. Right. And the main point, you know, why I don't want lasers, and I, you know, is something which is carefully left out at this explanation at this point. And you know, what I leave out is basically when you put in that much energy into the system, what you will get is an enormous amount of other excitations, thermal excitations, phonons, whatnot, spin waves, whatever you have, right? And the only thing to ever see this stuff is to look at relatively short timescales before you get to the regime where you couple to all the other stuff. Now, there was a talk on Tuesday by Chamla, who is trying to look at some of this stuff in his ultra-fast optics. But I'm very doubtful that one can actually get this in optics. But let's see. So now, let me study a toy model. And this is not a realistic model, although this is theoretical theory, if you want. Although I'm in a realistic workshop, but okay. So here's the Hubbard model, which you all know and love, and which has kinetic term, has the interaction term. And then the only thing I'm going to add here is this external perturbation, which I just write in this way, and I just assume a monochromatic perturbation and coupled to some operator A. Now, if you really want to consider electric field or current coupling of the light, then you should write down here a current operator, and that's something I will come back to later. Now, if I just say, I have some external perturbation, which is basically some sort of density multiplied with local amplitudes, then we can still do it. And in the end, we will be interested in the Q equals zero limit anyway. And if you think about it, it looks like a chemical potential. And what you do is you do dope the system time dependently. So that's one thing you can do, right? Now, the Hamiltonian is explicitly time dependent. So the energy is not conserved. It's just a trivial statement. But if you just think about it for a sec, then you understand that if you have an energy, it's conserved up to an integer multiple of the driving frequency. That's just what you have in Bloch's 300. So that is not a big problem. Now, when we write down this cosine of omega, what we really mean by this is that we do not want to heat up the system. We take out the same amount of energy as we put in another period. So in that sense, we would like to keep the temperature in some ways fixed, which is also not completely realistic.
So yes. Hartmut, even the case where all the AIs are equal.
Yes, then it just commutes with the Hamiltonian, with the rest of the Hamiltonian, and then just,
Just the Western center.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Right, but it still means that you are somehow pumping in and out
electrons.
You're doping the system in a time-dependent manner. So.
Right. So, there is a tricky question of limits, which one has to address here. And we will see later that we can do an example where we don't have to address this question in that carefully. But in principle, what it means is that you're re-changing the chemical potential in some ways, and you're driving in particles. And that when you then really want to consider this, then you have to consider the boundary of the system. Because particles are coming in and particles are coming out, right? And that we never do. And that's where this question of limit really lies.
And you always stick to the purely harmonic time range. You never switch on the perturbation at some time.
You will see. Okay. I didn't tell you everything. So. Okay. Now, then we make another big assumption. And as I said, the only justification for me standing here and telling you anything is that this is a huge problem, and one can make tiny progress on this, and one has to make approximations to get anywhere. Now, what we assume here is that we can still describe the time evolution by a density matrix. That's a big assumption. And if you think about these statistical mechanics problems, then you know that you cannot do that anymore. So in some ways, we are out of equilibrium, but not that far off. And the way you can describe the system then is that you take the Keldysh formalism, and the Keldysh formalism is just a statement about the time development of your operators, and it says that you start from some given ground state, you develop the system to some point, and then you don't know where the system will end up in some non-equilibrium state. So what you do is you come back to your original ground state, and if you think about it formally, what you have to do is basically doubling the fields in your theory, and then you just have to keep track of all these branches of the new Green's function, and then you have three, basically, the two standard. Yes?
First sentence.
Any time.
I don't understand your first sentence. You have the Feynman equation for your density matrix for if you take just your system and arbitrary perturbation, then you still look at the time development of your density matrix.
If I take the whole system and I describe the density matrix of the whole system, but usually what we do is we assign a temperature to the system, which is given to us by a thermal bath, which is coupling to the system. And I'm just saying, we still have that, we still have this assumption in there.
Actually, Cohen Fenucci has looked at that problem in some detail.
I see.
We can talk about it later, but.
Right. This is a very long and complicated explanation for something which is relatively simple still, but it's a big assumption in my view.
Produce a reduced density matrix is what you're really talking about.
Yeah, right.
But then you start from a system which, for example, is in equilibrium.
Yes.
And then you switch on this time-dependent view, and hopefully after long enough time till all the transients will decay, and then you're just left with this oscillatory link.
Right. And that's basically what I'm going to talk about here in this part.
Am I correct when saying that there is an implicit assumption behind the Keldysh formalism, which is that, as you just say, we have a system which is at thermal equilibrium, and then at t equal to zero, we branch on the perturbation, but we assume that the populations are basically set by the original thermal bar, and
that's
going to change this population.
Yeah.
But in a mesoscopic system, that's of course a really valid assumption because you have these huge leads and you have something small that is interacting, but in a lattice problem, it's less clear. I agree.
Right. Okay, so let's look at some very simple problem, which is the non-interacting case, and then everybody can solve it. Basically what you look at is the equation of motion of your electron operators, and what you get is basically some sort of oscillatory term in addition to the usual time development of the operator. And if you decompose it into energy eigenstates, then again, as I said before, you get these integer multiples of this driving frequency, but you also get a factor here, which is this Bessel function, which just describes the decay of the sidebands in this simple electron problem. Okay, so when you have that, then we can start to do something. And what we say is the following. In a general system, where we do not know anything, then in principle the time dependence of the Green's function, you really have to take into account the two time arguments because we don't have translation and variance in time anymore. Now, because we have this only the single driving frequency, we can decompose this Green's function still into two different time arguments. One is the time difference and one is the sum. And because we have this periodic driving frequency, we can decompose it into sidebands. So what we will end up is a Green's function which has sideband indices and a frequency. And that's all you need. This is just standard Fluke theory. It's nothing very unusual. The only thing you have to get used to is that energy is not conserved. It's only conserved in up to integer multiples of the frequency. So we just write it in this way. Now, when we write down the single particle propagators, we get something like this, and then you can see that these Green's functions, in these Green's functions, the Bessel functions are appearing as some trivial matrix elements, which is just describing the decay into the sidebands. Okay, so there's nothing unusual. This is the retarded Green's function. This is the Kalish Green's function in this formalism. Okay. Now, then of course you can go through all of the usual stuff, and you can write down a Dyson equation, and then you basically get a self-energy, and we will make the assumption again that the self-energy only depends on the frequency. And again, this is a very big assumption in this problem, and I will tell you why I have worries about that. But then you can basically set up the usual standard formalism, except that for the retarded and advanced part of the Green's function is the same, but the Kalish part is a little bit more complicated. And then what we will end up doing is we basically calculate the self-energy within the iterated perturbation theory. And because we are only looking at steady state solutions where all the transients are gone, we think that this is still a reasonable approach.
Okay. I have a question on that. If I look at the extreme atomic, just at the atomic limit when there is no hopping,
yes,
then presumably the problem can be easily handled.
Right, but
I just have four states. Right?
Right, and what will happen is there is something very trivial. What you will get is just phase vectors.
Yes.
So there's nothing.
Nothing interesting.
Probably, yes.
But at least does that IPT out of equilibrium reproduces the correct answer?
Actually, I didn't check that. I have to.
Because the rationale for the underlying success
right,
of the method
right,
at
right.
equilibrium, which is that if at half spinning it has the correct U equals zero and the correct atomic
right.
limit, so it
yes.
doesn't do the bad job in
Yeah. Between. At this point, we just assumed that. But it's worthwhile checking. Yes.
Surely something interesting happens when the original atomic states separations are degenerate with respect to omega.
Oh yeah, sure. No, but I was just thinking about the Hubbard stuff here.
And this is in the absence of any bath, right?
Right.
Isolated system.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Now, the next thing we do is we derive some DMFT equations. And basically, the only thing you really have to do is you have to go through the whole derivation of this DMFT, the cavity construction, and see, if all of that still works. And, that's what we did. And in the end, we will end up with an action which basically looks, again, local. And the only difference is that we really have the time dependence in here, and we have to worry about this this time-dependent potential. And this is the main advantage of using the DMFT at this point. There, you could imagine there are many, many different methods to attacking the non-equilibrium problem. But the thing we really would like to attack here is something which is, the dynamics of it. And the only way you can get a handle at this point of the dynamics of a strongly interacting system is the DMFT. There are some attempts, to study problems with DMRG in the dynamic range, but, I will talk about that later.
So
you will accumulating more and more things to later. Yes.
So you have basically one impurity problem per site, because now the sites are obvious.
Right. And that's the next approximation, which is hidden, in there. Basically, the one thing which, stopped me publishing this stuff for a long time was the question, now, if you have this strong frequency-dependent driving force, then the question is, how much time does it take to equilibrate the system locally? So, we have a mean field around this one single site, and, it has to know somehow about the equilibration process in time. And, this thing is rapidly, going back and forth on the site, so, it is a question. But in the end, when we looked at small clusters, we thought we convinced ourselves that it's actually doable. So up to now, actually, I haven't done anything very bad. And I even kept the Q dependence in most of the stuff, like the Dyson equation and in this perturbation. Now, in the cavity construction, when we do the standard stuff, and you have to remember that this is also a Green's function in sideband space. The only thing which is where this Q equals zero limit comes into play when we want to take care of the second term, and we have to do this Fourier transform, and here's the Q equals zero limit. And that's the point, where you could start to argue that this is just a conservation law which you have to apply and you don't have to worry about it. But you will see, I mean, that something interesting is coming out. And I can show you in the second part problem where we actually did something which has, you know, if you want a finite queue and gives you basically the same result. Now, you know, basically what we have done then is gone through the self-consistency equation. And you have to remember this is a DMFT problem, but now it's many DMFT problems because you have the Seidman index. And so what you solve instead of, you know, one single impurity problem is you have to solve many impurity problems. Now this would, you know, this would be impossible if you don't know about Bessel functions. Now the Bessel functions are decaying relatively rapidly, actually exponentially for large index n. So that means that you don't have to worry about all of the sidebands, and you can cut off in some sideband space. So what we did was then to treat, you know, 7 sidebands, 21 sidebands, and so on, and we tried, I mean, see if things were converging or not. And it turned out, I mean, that it was not so bad, and we could actually live with something like 14 sidebands in the end. Okay, now with this, these spectral functions, you can calculate the Weiss fields and then, you know, go back to the DMFT and, you know, just crank through the whole thing. And, you know, this is what I would like to show you first.
Just before you come to the reference.
Yes.
The Weiss fields still have this subband index, right?
Yes.
So how do these different modes actually couple through the self-consistency or maybe in
previous? Yeah, basically it's in the self-consistency. I mean, when you look at this stuff, oh yeah, right, and this is one thing which I forgot. You know, this is still a matrix in Seidman space,
mm-hmm.
and in Kellish space, and
you know, have to invert it. So.
And you have to invert it. And so this is an interesting problem. I think many of you have seen before. I mean, and stumbled upon if you try to do DMFT in a larger space. So what you want to do here is to do this Hilbert transform relatively efficiently. And there's a very simple way. I mean, just as a technical remark. What you do is assure decomposition of this thing. And it turns out that you don't have to redo this frequency integration, but you do assure decomposition. Then you do a transformation of the diagonal, which is, you know, just the standard Hilbert transform of the density of states. And then you go back and reverse the Schur transformation. You know, if you don't understand that, please come to me and talk to me afterwards. It's a technical detail, but it's very simple and it's very fast. Yeah, it's extremely useful for clusters, and it is tons. You know, if you try to do this integral by hand, I mean, let's say, I mean, numerically, just integrating it, I mean, you're dead. It just takes too long, and it's not very useful. I mean, just as a technical aside. Yeah, that was a little technical problem which kept us for a few days. So, okay. Yes. Right. This is where this, you know, the original ground state comes into play. Now, results. What I would like to show you is, I mean, this imaginary part of the Green's function, and as a function of for some typical driving frequency, let's say 1, as a function of the amplitude of the driving field. So what you get for A equals 0 is something which, you know, you have seen before, which is just the 2 Hubbard bands and then the spectral. This quasi-particle peak in the middle. Now, when you increase the driving amplitude, what you will get is something which, you know, is distributed much, much more. And what you will end up with is something which is nearly equally distributed and looks more or less like the original, you know, density of states. But it has nothing to do with it. It's really, I mean, what you are looking at is some sort of quasi-particle density of states, which is spread out all over, and it's not in the equilibrium state, it's in the steady state, right? So you have to remember, right? So this is, you know, only a caricature of, you know, the original density of states, if you want.
This is starting from the metal.
Sorry?
The U is such that you're in the metallic phase.
Yes, we are still in the metallic phase, and, you know, we didn't want to push the IPT, and that's one thing which we still would like to do. I mean, really go to the Mott transition and, you know, see, look from there. Now, what I show here is just, you know, to show you, I mean, how this Green's function, which I showed you just before, is decomposed into these side bends, and you see these additional wiggles. This is not an artifact of the IPT, but this is just the driving frequencies. And what you see here is the different side bends, and you see there's a lot of structure in these side bends, but you also see that they are relatively rapidly decaying, and you know, there's some peak structure still around here, but it's rapidly decaying as a function of side bend index. Okay, then if you look at the distribution function, what you see is something interesting, which I also didn't expect, but you can imagine it relatively easily. What happens is that you transfer states from here to here just by pushing the states around by this external driving frequency. So this is basically the driving frequency from here to here. Okay. Now, next problem. And I'm not even up to my second talk, but I was told, I have 1.5 hours. I don't know if everybody agreed on that, but.
Can you come back to this?
Yes.
And tell me you're more precise.
Yes. Right, sorry. So this is, if you want some measure of the particle distribution. It's not really, what you would just have in a regular system like CI, Dagger, CI. It's some component of the Kalish form. It's the Kalish component, basically, of this formalism. If you just, as I said before, if you go to the Q equals zero limit and you just take all the AIs in the external perturbation to be equal, then you don't see anything in this distribution function. But if you go back to the Kalish formalism and look at the Kalish component, which tells you about the density of states, about the distribution function, then you will get this. And as you said, there's a question of order of limits, and that's why I want to show you the next problem.
If you look at the difference of that compared to the step function, is that exactly odd?
Yeah.
Looks like it's.
Well, it should be exactly odd. Here you see a little bit of the effect of the interaction. And
same steps up there that you see down.
Well, it's asymmetric in any event. You have some effect of the distribution, of the interaction, but then, it is not completely symmetric. But
if that was equilibrium, this would be just n of k or not?
Yes.
It would be.
Right. In this Kalish formalism, you would get the same thing as n of k. Okay, so now.
I'm sorry, again, equilibrium
yes.
means steady state, right? There is no.
Here I mean steady state.
There is no
back. If I set the driving force to zero, just the amplitude of this external perturbation to zero, then I would get n of k in the same formalism. Mm-hmm. So it gives you back something which is reasonable, which is, at least one sanity check, but. Okay, so now let's look at a different problem, which taken basically from the excitonic insulator in a time-dependent field. And what you have here is an external perturbation, which actually couples the two bands of the A and the Bs. And so you have some time-dependent perturbation which actually mixes the band. So this is corresponding to doing a finite Q in some ways, because if you think about just the for example current operator, you have CK plus Q, there you have a mixing of two different bands, and here this is the simplest case which we could study where we have two different bands and where the stuff is not conserved. Now there you could play the same games and do a self-consistency equation, and the G and the Green's function here are matrices in Kalish space and frequency space, and the DMT Green's function again is supposed to be local, and we do the same Dyson equation as we did before. Now, in that case, we also looked at the time-dependent response. So what we did was just apply a pulse and then see how this excitonic gap really develops, and what I've shown here is the excitonic gap as a function of frequency and as a function of time. And what you see is basically that after a pulse, you see the gap decreasing and then doing these wiggles, And these bigots are determined by the parameters of the system. And you know, in this case, where we choose the external perturbation to be relatively small, you end up with the same gap, but you could actually drive the system to a different gap by this external perturbation. And this is not steady state now. This is, I mean, just frequency. And if you would like to look at the change in the distribution function, what you see here is basically the difference between the Fermi distribution function and the time-dependent stuff. And what you see here is that you're pushing weight from small frequencies. Sorry, this is the Fermi energy, and this is below the Fermi energy. This is above the Fermi energy. And what you see is these wiggles, so that the weight in this distribution function wiggles back and forth, which you know is determined by the parameters of the system. And we haven't, you know, this is relatively new. We haven't looked at the dependence of this frequency on the parameters of the system, but you know, you see something interesting here in any event.
Okay. How you calculate this time dependence when you're not doing Fouquet theory anymore?
Right. So what we do then is, I mean, we again make this assumption that you can write the self energy in the same, you know, in this IPT way, and then we just integrate the differential equations. It's horrible. Yes. It took us a while, like 2 years. And you know, these are, you know, results which are relatively recent, like, you know, a week from today, a week ago. So it's yeah. But you know, we certainly will have some more stuff. And I decided to put this stuff in because, I mean, of your question. And I think, you know, in this problem, you remix the bands and you can do the non-equilibrium stuff, and you're really sure that you're actually not, you know, running into these problems with the order of limits and the conservation law.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
I just don't know. Even before I go to non-equilibrium, I would like to know where physically the excitonic interaction comes from in the DMFT. Because basically, if I do standard diagrammatic approaches and calculate the exciton from the two-particle correlation functions, then I would have the rule that my irreducible interaction, which gives me the electron-hole interaction, is related, of course, due to a functional derivative to the self-energy. So if the self-energy is local, how can I get a non-local electron-hole interaction, which I need for the exciton?
Well, what we basically assumed is, you know, as I said, this is only motivated by the excitonic models, but what we basically put in by hand is this term, and that's, you know, supposed to give you this interaction. So you know, that's all I want to study at this point. I mean, you know, it's not, I'm not saying this is a model for excitonic insulators. I'm saying this is motivated by
your self-energy matrix in AB space.
Yes. Right.
The model is here, right?
Yeah. It's just a two-band model with some precisely
a gap between them.
Right.
That's it.
Yes.
Okay, it's a matrix in AB space, so you get one diagonal matrix.
Okay.
So you put it in by hand.
Yes.
Not from the repulsive direction, for example.
Right.
That's right.
Right. No, but you know, my objective is here different one. I mean, what I would like to look at is very simple models where I can see something which, you know, can say something about non-equilibrium physics. Now, I just want to make a snippy remark about my competitors. So there's some interesting work by basically Brett Marston and this person, I don't know, Casaleda. So sorry, if somebody knows him, I mean, or her, I would be pleased to talk to her or him. But you know, this is something which I looked at and I was first shocked. I thought, you know, this is it. I mean, you know, I can go home now and I don't have to worry about these things anymore. So what these people did was they tried to apply the DMRG to the non-equilibrium problem. Now, on a single, you know, there's an interaction only on a single side. Now, the problem with that is, I mean, number one is DMRG and dynamics is a very complicated problem already. And many people have played with this. And actually, I claim that my student, Till Kuhner, actually did the first reasonable calculation of spectral functions with DMRG. And you know, that was a very complicated business with correction vector method and so on. Now, you have to do that, I mean, in order to get all the states in a frequency range. If you look at finite frequency, the DMRG is not geared for calculating spectral weights at some finite energy. What you have to do is then, you know, do target states which also target this finite frequency state or finite energy state. They didn't do that. They just took the standard DMRG, optimized the wave functions for the ground state, and then took this truncated Hamiltonian and wrote down a Schrodinger equation for this truncated Hamiltonian with the Hilbert space optimized for, you know, low energies. Then they did a time development, and then they showed these figures in their paper, which looked very nice. I mean, here you have the time development, here you have some, you know, this is the problem they consider, basically a chain with an impurity. And they, you know, if you look at the figures, you cannot really distinguish between the exact solution and the TDMRG. The only thing they don't tell you, if you read the paper, if you do not read the paper carefully, is that the comparison is only done for the non-interacting case. If I just do this time development with the non-interacting case, you know, it's perfect. There's no problem. You do not ever mix states. You do not ever get into this all these complications I talked about. Sorry.
Everything's missing in the Schrodinger equation.
Oh yeah, sorry. There's a time derivative.
Right.
Yeah, I just plugged it in. I mean, just before I came here. But okay. Anyway, so there's a Schrodinger equation, and I mean, if this were the Schrodinger equation in their paper, I agree, it would be disaster.
So this shows one doesn't have to write equations because everybody understands anyway.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. So sorry, but okay. I hope you get the point anyway. And you know, don't look at this. Look at this. the point is, I mean, that the comparison is done for zero interaction only, and then it should work in any event. And so I think there's a point one has to address. And if one does the TDMRG for the interacting system and compares to the interacting system, I would be happy to see a comparison, and I'm sure it won't work. So that's my point of that.
Can I understand again what you just said? I mean, what is the reason for
the reason is basically, you know, they hit the system with a pulse,
okay.
Right? So what that means is you have all frequency components in there.
Mm-hmm.
You go up to an enormously high frequency. You know, if I consider just the problems I talked about, you go to another band or you go to the Hubbard band.
Mm-hmm.
You have, and then you excite all the states up there,
mm-hmm.
Right? You're never going to get this physics with this truncated Hamiltonian. You're sitting down, you know, you're caged in this limited Hilbert space down close to zero. And you're not, you know, addressing this question of, you know, what happens.
Well, I mean, that basically means that the elimination procedure is correct as long as your high energies that you eliminate are large enough as compared to the amplitude of the energy over which the perturbation spreads.
So right.
Then you should stop and do something else. That's what you're saying.
Yes. And the point is, I mean, they, you know, if you are optimizing for zero frequency, then you know you do not have to go away that far. I mean, to really lose the accuracy of the DMRG, number one, and that number two is they consider a delta pulse, which has all frequencies, right?
So. Even for non-interacting problems, yes. If you hit with a strong enough pulse, you run into problems with the DMRG.
Right.
Even with this,
yes.
So
right.
In a sense, there is something nice in the fact that they can introduce an
non-interacting
problem, or would you say that it's
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, why it does that? But you know, I would be even worried about that. Yes,
but
please.
This really, I completely agree with you about the DMRG. The DMRG by construction, I would just not take for this type of problem because of limited Hilbert space. But I would. Honestly, also not have taken DMFT because of different reasons. Namely, I do not believe that a local self-energy will solve your problem. It just contradicts what I would think happens in a many-body system if you apply a strong external perturbation to the system. So you really have to convince at least me and maybe other people that by comparison with non-local self-energy perturbation, for a simple model,
right.
This is a realistic
right.
Okay. To take the
two answers. Answer number one, if you do a perturbation fast, then you know the perturbation does not have time to spread that far. So in my view, I mean, you know, it's more local. I mean, the effect of the perturbation will be more local the stronger the perturbation, or you know, the higher frequency the perturbation is. The other question is, I would defer you to the future and tell you that, I mean, at this workshop we talked to several people here, and we are thinking of, you know, trying to do this cluster DMFT to, you know, really see what the non-local effects are. And then, I mean, that would give you two advantages. One is the you know, you don't have to worry about your objection, and you would also address basically your non-local self-energy question. So, yes.
Can I ask a question related to that comment?
Yes.
Certainly at equilibrium, at least we can rationalize in some limit, say large coordination, the use of a local self-energy. Okay. So let me understand your worry. You are saying that even in that limit, if I look at a time-dependent perturbation, you would think that the spatial dependence becomes very important again?
Yeah, I mean, let's say I'm close to an anti-ferromagnetic metal insulator transition. Then I could just imagine that you go by strong perturbation, actually you mix anti-ferromagnetic local tendencies, for example, with metallic tendencies. And you know that for the anti-ferromagnetic description, you need, in fact, local and non-local.
Wait, but then you have a problem at equilibrium.
No, but I'm just saying,
DMFT,
I could imagine that you really get into a very non-local dependence. I mean, the self-energy arc from our prime, yeah, tells me that I'm looking at effects on the electron at R of other particles at R prime. And my feeling would be that if you have a very strong perturbation, that your R prime, which is the other electrons, this can be very far away.
That's because you started with a system which has a large coalition length to start with. Imagine you start with a system which has very small coalition length.
Well, I'm just not believing that if you have a strong perturbation, you can apply these homogeneous-like concepts.
No, I completely agree with you that there is a question, and I think within this, you know, cluster DMFT, one can at least get a hint of what will happen in the sense that your short range correlation
calculation is already so complicated that if you complicate it even more with your scheme,
yes,
it's probably very hard to elevate.
It is hard, but I mean, it may not be impossible. I mean, I talked with Gabi, and he has actually a student, and I have a student, and I think we will get together and, I mean, actually do something about it. It may take some time, but, you know, we'll see. As I said, I think it's an interesting problem. So let me just conclude and then go to my second talk. Yes, please.
I think it really depends on the nature of the perturbation that you have. If you have something that you had in mind in the first part of your talk,
yes,
like a time-dependent doping, then that's one sort.
Right.
If you have really a laser,
right,
which couples to the current, I mean, even classically, the electrons go forth and back in the sample.
Right, but
so,
you know,
so
for that,
you really have something like a time-dependent hopping.
Right, I agree.
To the static, right. It's a different story.
I completely agree, and I think, you know, at the time when we were doing this first calculation, we didn't have the cluster DMFT at our disposal. You know, now, I mean, there's at least some progress, and we hope, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I'm here. You know, we hope to learn enough, I mean, that we can actually apply this stuff. And then we also could get some more realistic measurements.
But even worse, so even with this time-dependent chemical potential, without having a bath, there's no doping because the number of...
Right.
No,
I agree.
Then you could get it, but the way you've done it, there's nothing happens. And then I come back to the question, you're in an omega. Does it have any physical meaning?
Right. No, I mean, I think one has to clarify these questions in these cluster DMFT model. Otherwise, I mean, one does not make progress. And I, you know, your question is very valid, I mean, on that point. Okay, so again, you know, what we have tried, and I really tried to qualify this in the beginning, I mean, that, you know, this was really an attempt to address some problem in DMFT with non-equilibrium problems. So what we have looked at are two problems. One is a periodically driven problem. Then the second is a short pulse problem, the question of a short pulse in this Sorov excitonic insulator. Now the problem we need to address, and which are very clear, is we need a more realistic coupling to the external field. That's obvious. And we need also a better understanding of the impurity problem in the non-equilibrium. And this is something which you know, is very vital and important before we can make much more progress on that. And there are various attempts on studying this stuff at the moment on the impurity problem. And then the question which remains is really, what could you use, to do an experimental realization? And as I said, the boson, the bosons are definitely in that regime where you can look at the question, that the interaction and the driving force and so on are in the same energy range. So there you can actually do it, but it would be much more interesting if one could do fermionic problems, but the people who are doing optical lattices and atoms are actually trying to do also the fermionic system, and I have some hope that one actually might look at these problems to get some experimental realization of the physics I describe. Okay, so this is the end of my first talk. So I have a second part prepared for this. I think it would not be wise, to start this at this point. The question is basically extensions of DMFT for spatial fluctuations, but I think we should leave this better to the discussion section tomorrow. And I'm sorry if I have taken up too much of your time, and I thank you for the patience. Okay, thank you very much.